This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello. Welcome to the In Conversation series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Dr. Seanet Chanderson, Chartered Research Psychologist and Neurodiversity Consultant with expertise in Tourette syndrome. I'm excited to be here today as this is the second in a series of podcasts that ACAM is hosting on Tourette syndrome. Over the course of this series, we'll be looking at the latest research-based evidence, what's in the pipeline, together with insights from mental health professionals, those working with young people, and tips for parents. I'll be talking to leading players in the field, rising stars of research, clinicians, and experts by experience. Today, I'm interviewing Lucy Toghill, who is the education manager at the charity Tourette's Action. In her role, Lucy consults with schools and education professionals to optimise understanding of and support for pupils with Tourette syndrome. Lucy has worked in mainstream schools as a primary school teacher for 15 years before joining Tourette's Action, and she has a son with Tourette syndrome. Today, we're going to be talking about the role of schools and clinics or health professionals in the lives of young people with Tourette syndrome or tic disorders. Lucy, welcome.
Thank you for having me today.
So before we start, I'm just going to give a brief overview of what Tourette syndrome, or TS, is. It's a neurological condition that is estimated to affect over 300,000 children and adults in the UK, and that's one school child in every 100, so which is the same prevalence as autism at about 1%. The main symptoms are physical and vocal tics, which typically develop in childhood, and tics can be simple, such as eye blinking and sniffing, through to complex movements and vocalizations that can, at the extreme end, be incredibly debilitating. For TS to be diagnosed, multiple motor tics and at least one vocal tic must be present for at least 12 months. Another issue that we'll discuss later is that tics wax and wane and change in their nature across time. There is more information about TS on the ACAM website with a very useful topic guide. Lucy, I'd like to start by asking, how did you become interested in Tourette syndrome?
I worked for a teacher in schools for many years and through that developed a special interest for SEN very early on in my career, actually. And then I had my son, who's now 14, and he was diagnosed with Tourette syndrome when he was 7. It was a really tough time, not just to get the diagnosis, but especially getting school to understand and get the right support in place for him. Tourette's Action really helped me and my family, and I started volunteering for them at this time. And then the job came up, and I went for it. And I realised how important the role was, actually, and how important it could be to so many families. And so the role developed really into what is now it is now, and we can now offer so much support to families and schools, which is great.
And can you describe some of the work you do as education manager? You've described support. What does that look like?
My main role is really to liaise with schools and parents to help them understand the needs of children with Tourette syndrome in school and to provide them with support and advice and teacher training and resources, really just to best support the child in question. Before COVID, we used to do workshops around the UK for teachers to attend. Because of COVID, I've sort of had to adapt that training into an online, a free training resource, an online package for teachers that they can easily access. And we also do webinars for both schools, teachers and parents to help get the information out there. That does sometimes mean that I am contacted by health professionals like educational psychologists, school nurses, mental health workers, CAMs and clinicians. They're all interested in knowing how best to support the children.
And it sounds like you try and take the whole school approach, as it were, and try and get all the staff a little bit more knowledgeable about Tourette syndrome. It's not just, of course, teachers that the pupils come into contact with.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really important that this is the case, and it's really important that a child is able to attend school. And in order to do that, We need to make sure that the child is fully supported, they're fully understood, they feel fully accepted by the whole school community, not just that class teacher. And, you know, it's important to remember that children are in school more than they are at home. You know, school's job to work alongside parents to nurture these children, to become very balanced individuals as they develop into adulthood and go off and find work in the real world, in the lives of the real world. If we had a child in school that had epilepsy, for example, or an allergy, we wouldn't allow that child to go to school unless the whole school had training on how to deal with that specific condition and manage those situations, much like, you know, an EpiPen training. You know, if a child had an allergy, all the teachers would have to know how to equip themselves in EpiPen training. So the same needs to be said for children with Tourette syndrome, really, in my eyes. Unless teachers fully understand those hidden barriers to learning that a child with Tourette syndrome may have, then how are they going to be able to even begin to understand how, you know, that child learns and how best to teach them? So we really want our children to have full access to the curriculum and be able to reach their full potential like every other child. And the same goes for other children in school. Children are very accepting and receptive generally to diversity and differences. And I see that every day in my job. You know, we get feedback from teachers that say that they've shown the class the Tourette's Action peer presentation that we provide and what a huge difference it has made to that child in question. We have to be totally led by each individual child, and some children are happy to suppress or control their tics and don't want people knowing all about their condition, and we have to accept that too.
And you mentioned the peer presentation that Tourette's Action provides. Could you tell us a little bit more about what that looks like?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's really a PowerPoint presentation aimed at children, and it's something the child can get involved in. If you've got a child that's very confident and they want to lead a class talk or an assembly, they can absolutely do that, and that's lovely. But if you are a child that, you know, or a parent that wants that information to come across to the rest of the school or the class, and they may not want to be involved in that, and that's fine, but, you know, the teacher can then deliver that.
And so the work that you do, it sounds mainly school focused, but it also sounds like you've got lots of information that might be of interest to healthcare professionals. What's on offer specifically to that group of people?
We do encourage any health professional to take our training, although it's focused on schools. I think there's a lot they can gain from that, or attend one of my webinars, and many do. We have lots of health professionals come along to that, many CAMHS or mental health services. I think there is a lot to be learned for these professionals in knowing what real life is like, you know, day to day for these children in school. Many of the charities we work very closely with that support the other co-occurring conditions would say exactly the same, you know.
Yes, and you mentioned the co-occurring conditions. These are commonly things like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, or obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. And I think we've sort of found in the past that 80 to 85% of patients with Tourette syndrome also have these co-occurring conditions as well, and sometimes can be perhaps more problematic than the tics themselves. I guess we're also using the term healthcare professionals to sort of mean anyone the young person might come into contact with during their journey through diagnosis and treatment. So that could be GPs, nurses, neurologists, psychiatrists, psychologists, and also occupational therapists and paediatricians, and any of those working in the CAMHS service, which we mentioned already. I know that Lucy and I have both spoken with parents who report these challenges around school for children with Tourette syndrome. And you mentioned these hidden barriers to learning. Sometimes these are quite sort of neglected areas, and it would be nice to talk to you a little bit about some of those. Have you found with teachers, for example, that it can often be difficult to tell what is a tic, which is actually a tic, or what's a behaviour? It might be quite difficult for them to tease them apart. And what is sort of naughty behaviour? What would you say about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the number one question, actually, that I get asked every time, you know, if I go into a school or I speak to a school. Teachers will often ask me, you know, is this a tic or is this neurotypical bad behaviour? You know, and it's often very difficult to unpick that at times, and even parents report, you know, and I know from my son in the very early days of diagnosis, I wasn't quite sure what was a tic, what was OCD, what was him being, you know, neurotypically misbehaving. But it's really a question of getting to know that child. We need to spend time with this child at school. We need to ask the child, you know, I'm very pro pupil voice. I'm very pro teachers using a one-page profile to explain to other teachers about their condition. And we want the child to be involved in that as much as we can, really. We have had some teachers say that, you know, the child in question, it doesn't sound like a tic because they're being silly and everyone's laughing at them. But, you know, what I say to teachers is let's consider this, you know, from a child's point of view, it's actually a lot easier to be accepted in class, to be seen to be naughty, than it is to be seen to ticking and apparently being seen by your friends as being weird and different. So I think it's important just to let health professionals know and schools know that, you know, this can happen to children, and to be aware of those children that are struggling in that way.
We know that Tourette syndrome has no effect on IQ. There's no cognitive deficits, as it were, but there are issues with learning. I think a common theme is often that there are some executive functioning difficulties. Certain tics can actually interfere with learning. Is that also your experience?
The symptoms around Tourette syndrome can have a massive impact on a child's ability to learn. For example, hand tics, I mean, that would be quite obvious if a child's not able to write. You know, if a child's got OCD, they might rip up their paper, scribble out their writing. We know that children have visual tics. They might be looking around the room and counting things, you know, and all the other co-occurring conditions that come along with that. And as you said, Seanid, you know, it's not the tics themselves sometimes that are these barriers to learning. But, you know, with ADHD, you've got the distraction and the lack of concentration. And you mentioned executive functioning skills there, Seanid, and that's really important. And this is something that doesn't affect every child with Tourette syndrome, but certainly when you talk to teachers, and certainly in the work that I do, educational psychologists will probably back this up, really, from my experience, that executive functioning difficulties is something that we see commonly in children with Tourette syndrome. And, you know, we're talking basically about those three main set of mental skills, which are working memory, flexible thinking, and self-control. And these can affect things such as organisational skills, planning and focusing, starting and finishing tasks, and moving from one task to another. So for this, we need to be modelling in school these set of skills, really, and scaffolding that for children. And we need to be giving children the time to process their thought, and giving time for pause and effect, and keeping those expectations clear and consistent all the time.
So that's the kind of academic side, but there's also this element with some people with Tourette syndrome. Now, this is a bit of a myth that having a diagnosis of Tourette syndrome means that you will have the swearing tic or coprolalia. But actually, research has found that only about 10% of people with Tourette syndrome will have that coprolalia tic. But there can be it can be challenging and confronting nature of that, and also other tics as well, where it's not socially appropriate to say something, but a tic will come out, and its effect on other students and teaching staff as well. Is that something you've come across?
I actually see a lot of children with coprolalia, because it's actually one of the most difficult things to manage in schools, as you can imagine, with safeguarding. And that's both for children and staff. You know, we've had staff that, even though they've had the training and they totally understand that this condition is involuntary and there's no malice behind the tic, if you've got a child that is particularly obsessed with one staff member, and you know, and they're picking out personal things about them, you know, their tics are making them say things about them that are quite personal. We need to take care of staff. You know, there may be times that staff are not happy to put up with that all the time. We need to consider that. You know, I advise schools really to have a point of contact in school, in their pastoral team, for someone that's trained that both students and staff can go to if they've been upset by someone's tics. And also another thing we ask, or we suggest people put in place when schools ask us, is that they possibly have a letter that they can send home to parents, obviously with the permission of the child in question and their parents, to help explain Tourette syndrome and nip any bullying or complaints in the bud as soon as, you know, we get whiff of them. Schools, where possible, you know, we need to explain to other parents that the school is very supportive of this child, and they will be intending to make this child feel accepted by the whole community, and possibly offer parents at a coffee morning or afternoon to come in and talk about Tourette's and pick up some information and ask questions. You know, we don't want this to be a hidden condition within the school, because in the case of coprolalia, it's not going to be hidden at all. You know, it's going to be out there and it's going to be obvious to school. So I think we need to address it and be open to parents, really.
I know that through speaking to parents and teachers, other issues that come up for students with Tourette syndrome, things like disinhibition, we've talked about OCD as well, and lack of control perhaps, and there could be oppositional behaviours too. And rage is something that we hear often from parents, though this is perhaps more commonly seen at home than at school. And that can be a point of difficulty as well, with behaviours being slightly different between home and school environments. And we know that different environments can set off tics or bring them to the fore. And sensory integration issues as well can be fairly common with young people with Tourette syndrome as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, what I would say to clinicians and schools is that, you know, you've got a child, say there's an 8-year-old child with Tourette syndrome, they've been diagnosed. They don't really understand quite yet how it affects their body. But what they do know is that they've got lots of involuntary movements going on, and their body is making them say things they don't want to say and make sounds. So, you know, consider that child and think, well, no wonder that child has a lot of rage going on, you know, if their body is doing things that they don't want it to do. And as you said, Shawnee, you know, environmental factors are huge in this. We know, you know, even adults have reported to us that, you know, a change of environment, a change of smell, heat, touch, hearing, if there's a particularly acoustic sounding room, can all be triggers to setting off their tics. So again, it's very important that we use pupil voice and we talk to the child about what their triggers may be. And that can be very hard for a child with Tourette's. You know, a child may not know what their triggers are. We know about this premonitory urge, don't we? We know that, you know, some children and adults get that feeling before a tic comes, and that's something that therapists can work on for CBT. I just draw on an example I had before, Shawnee, if that's okay, that, you know, I went into a school that thought a boy didn't like maths, or he didn't like the maths teacher, and, you know, his tics would really kick off in maths. And actual fact, when we took this boy into the classroom, the maths classroom, you know, without maths and without the teacher, we sat him where he sits and we sort of tried to unpick what it was that was triggering off his tics in that situation. And it came to that it was the chair he was sitting on, and the chair was scratching on his school jumper. Now, I'm not saying this is, you know, it's as easy as that, but we took away the chair, and that he was much more settled in that class and less ticky. And as I said, I'm not saying it's easy and that easy in every situation, but do consider, you know, the effect that these environmental factors and sensory issues have on children with Tourette syndrome, because it's very common.
That's such an interesting example as well. And we haven't actually talked yet, I think, about children with Tourette syndrome actually trying to suppress and control their tics while learning. That can also, I would imagine, absorb a huge amount of energy and concentration from them to try and control their tics while they're in the classroom, and also subsequently affect their learning. They may not be able to take everything in, or have taken everything in regards to instructions and things like that, I would imagine.
Absolutely, Shawnee. Yeah, I mean, we know that trying to suppress a tic, and children, you know, we encourage in schools not to suppress, because we know that that can possibly have a knock-on effect, and we know that suppressing is very uncomfortable for people. That's what they report, and actually suppressing is very tiring. So you may have a child in class that presents very disengaged and bored and not learning, but you know, and that may be dealt with a behavior issue. But actually consider that all the time that you were doing the input, you know, in school, that child may have been ticking. And when you're ticking, you know, children tell us they can't concentrate because they're concentrating on that tick. Or, you know, the flip side of that is when you're suppressing, you know, it's not just ticking. When you're suppressing, you're very tired and you're trying to hold that in, and that takes a lot of concentration. So either way, you know, that child is going to have difficulties concentrating. So it's really important that we address that in school, and that the teacher acknowledges that, so that they can go and help the child after and make sure that they've understood.
We've been touching on this already, but could you talk a little bit more now about some of the, I think they're termed reasonable adjustments that schools could be asked to make for a student with Tourette syndrome?
I mean, we know that schools have to be seen to be making best endeavours, it's called, to meet all children's needs in school. They have a legal obligation to make what we call reasonable adjustments, as you mentioned. Now, most schools will be able to do that within their SEN budget, their current SEN budget. And most children with Tourette syndrome, to be fair, will be able to have access to this. And most of their needs will be able to be met. However, this does depend on the level of needs of the child. It's very rare that we see a child with just Tourette syndrome in school with pure Tourette's. In fact, as you mentioned before, John, it's around 80 to 85% of children with Tourette syndrome will have these co-occurring conditions, and the most common being ADHD, OCD, and autistic spectrum disorder. So if a child is presenting with other more serious needs from one of these other conditions, then it may be that, depending on their level of need, that schools are unable to meet their needs in the given budget that they have available to them. And in this case, we would look into applying for what we call an EHCP, which is an Educational Health and Care Plan, which is a legal document written by the local authority, which sets out all the support that the child needs and the provisions on how those needs are going to be met in school. Teachers will be responsible really for providing most of the evidence for that, but also all the health professionals involved in that child's care will be asked to submit reports and evidence to support that. And that could be educational psychologists, OTs, but anyone that's had input in that will be asked to submit a report. The Educational Health and Care Plan will also set out outcomes that will follow the child through to the age of 25, which is brilliant. And this will, of course, indeed come with funding sometimes, not all the time, but if depending on the need, comes with funding from the local authority to help those outcomes be achieved. As far as reasonable adjustments go, we would expect to see a child receive in school before Educational Health and Care Plan needs assessment would vary really. And we would expect that child to be receiving some support from maybe a teaching assistant. That's not to say, you know, certainly not one-to-one, just some time with that teaching assistant to oversee the help they need. Work could possibly be differentiated for the child. Interventions could be put in place to promote positive mental health. And we know that a lot of that work is going on this year with the impact of COVID. So our children are benefiting from that this year. Another strategy we may put in place is permission for a child to leave the classroom if they become overwhelmed or feel the need to have a break and let a few ticks out somewhere private. And that's very important, actually, that's followed through. We don't want the child just walking around the corridor. You know, we need to, again, using that pupil voice and making sure they understand the use of that tick pass and that maybe they want to take their work with them and go and meet someone rather than just, you know, walking around the school. And training for staff, you know, and that's a really important thing for them to have.
This is making me think about any challenges from students or their parents. Do you ever face challenges from students, their parents not wanting the school to know about their Tourette syndrome? You know, maybe a student refusing the support or the accommodations because they don't want to be singled out as different. I imagine it's probably adolescents or older adolescents, but have you come across that?
Yeah, I have in both primary and senior schools, actually. And it's, as I mentioned earlier, we have come across families where they wish to not be different from their from other pupils. And they wish not to have any special compensations for their disability. And we absolutely have to respect that, don't we? You know, we have to do our best to support those children in any way that we can that's acceptable to them. And we know, I mean, we know from studies mentioned that that doesn't always have the best positive outcome. You know, what are we showing that child if we are teaching them that they've got to hide part of who they are and they're not allowed to be themselves? And we know from studies that this can have a detrimental effect on mental health. But in some cases, actually, you know, this is the right thing for the child and we have to respect that.
And I would imagine also there are probably many more children with tics or tic disorders. We know that tics are a common part of childhood and there might be children who may not receive a diagnosis, but they would still have the tics present and would benefit from some kind of support as well. I think it's impossible not to mention COVID this year, and you mentioned it just a few moments ago. And is that something that you're building into your awareness for teachers? Because you and I both know that tics can often be quite suggestible. And so in an anxiety-provoking situation, tics that sort of come out might be the sort of worst option at that time to come out. So therefore, we're hearing a lot of people with Tourette syndrome saying that they've got sniffing and coughing tics, especially at the moment under the current situation as well. Is that something that you're speaking to schools about or trying to make teachers aware that these are tics that some of their Tourette syndrome students might be showing at the moment?
Yeah, we have had teachers get in contact about that. And I think, again, it's about getting to know the child, talking to the family. The COVID situation has exacerbated a lot of children's anxieties over the last 6 months. And we know, don't we, that, you know, anxiety fuels Tourette's and it fuels tics. And the suggestibility of COVID at the moment, you know, children have got, if they have vocal tics, it can be quite common at the moment to shout out, "I've got coronavirus," or to exacerbate the symptoms of that as a tic. You know, and I think it's really important that that is addressed with children and families. And schools have to be really careful. They have to safeguard themselves. You know, if they're unsure if it's a tic or not, you know, they probably would ask that child to be tested to make sure, because they would need the evidence for school. But I think, again, talking to parents and the child themselves, you know, I haven't found too many issues with it at the moment.
I'm really interested in the psychoeducation that you're offering, and just to bring in some research evidence behind those psychoeducation initiatives. Researchers from the National Hospital for Neurology and Neurosurgery, the University College London, and the Tourette Syndrome Clinic at Great Ormond Street Hospital carried out research examining the usefulness of psychoeducation for Tourette syndrome. And they looked at whether psychoeducation, in terms of giving other people such as teachers or classmates information about the condition, was an effective intervention for Tourette syndrome. And the research consisted of two parts. The first was a review of other studies examining the effects of giving information about Tourette syndrome or ADHD to children and adults, including peers and teachers. And the study found that giving factual information can make other people better informed and also lead them to think, feel and behave in more positive ways towards people with Tourette syndrome, at least in the research study. So just telling people the diagnosis the person has without explaining what it is doesn't seem to have such a positive effect. And the second research paper was an evaluation of what we'd spoken about earlier, the peer presentation. It involved children with Tourette syndrome recruited through Tourette's Action, and they were using the Tourette's Action primary school presentation. So the researchers asked teachers to give a presentation about Tourette syndrome to the classmates of four children with Tourette syndrome. And the classmates were given questionnaires before and after the presentation and interviewed in groups. So the children with Tourette syndrome, their parents and teachers were also interviewed. And the aim of the interviews, focus groups and questionnaires was to find out what impact the presentation had from these different perspectives. And the findings suggested that in general, the presentation increased the classmates' knowledge about Tourette syndrome, gave them more positive attitudes and behaviours towards the child with Tourette syndrome. It also appeared to help the children themselves with Tourette syndrome to feel more accepting of their condition, so more confident and less different. And the findings suggest that it is useful to educate other people about Tourette syndrome, and this will help improve the experiences of those living with the condition. As I said, that presentation has since been updated. That was from 2013. But we don't have a current evaluation of your presentation given in schools, but hopefully the impact of this new and improved presentation would be even greater than the previous one, building on it. What about your own experience as a parent sort of receiving diagnosis? Did you feel supported by school and healthcare services enough?
Well, you know, I feel very strongly about moving forward towards lessening that gap, as you know, Charlotte, and in services, especially to support families. And if schools and other services such as CAMHS shared all these resources, it would be great. And there would be so much we could do to make more of a positive message that's given at the point of diagnosis, in offering families that lifeline, really, and making them aware of services that are available to them, not just with medication, but with behavioural therapies and information on charities such as ours, so that they can feel so much more empowered and supported, and therefore less alone. And you talk about my own experience drawing on my son. You know, our experience, unfortunately, was waiting a long time to see CAMHS. You know, we were refused a referral at first, and then we were able to get one. And it was very much, we saw a psychiatrist who diagnosed us, and it was unfortunately just a case of, yeah, it's Tourette's syndrome, off you go. You know, and we were left to the point as, what does that mean? What is Tourette's syndrome? You know, we didn't have a lot of explanation, a lot of time to talk about that in the appointment. And I very quickly had to do my research as a parent as to what that meant for us and what that meant for my son in his life. You know, and it's very important to draw upon the effect of a parent and that grieving process that a parent goes through from receiving that shock of a diagnosis. You know, a parent may say, gosh, is anyone going to love my child like I do? Are they going to be able to get a job, hold down a job? And will they be able to get, you know, drive? And the answer to all those questions is absolutely yes. What is important is this, you know, the support we put in place and making sure that support is there for that child to make sure they can just carry on and thrive. So I think at point of diagnosis, there needs to be more support really for families so that they don't feel alone and they feel that they are supported by both school and the information they've received from their clinician.
I mean, we've definitely heard the issues from parents of children with Tourette syndrome about diagnosis and treatment. Why is it that it's so fraught with difficulties and challenges from the very start of parents noticing tics in their child and taking their child to the GP? It can be described as a bit of a battle for some. And obviously in some areas around the UK, it's working much more smoothly. So it's interesting looking at the differences between the parents describing this immense challenge and other families where it's much smoother. I know that we've talked a little bit about diagnosis. Quite often when a child with tics is taken to the GP, there will be a period of about a year of sort of watchful waiting to see if the tics come or go, or if they're still there after a year, then they might get referred. And we do hear about people bouncing around the system from maybe a GP to a paediatrician, maybe to a neurologist, maybe to CAMHS. And it seems like in some cases, healthcare professionals could be more educated about what Tourette syndrome is and what it isn't. We've heard of some healthcare professionals sort of saying, but your child isn't swearing, it can't be Tourette's, or maybe if they're sniffing, it's to do with an allergy. What would you say about this huge challenge and difficulty of getting diagnosis and treatment in some areas?
I think really, Shonage, it's because the diagnosis pathway varies so much in every NHS trust. And, you know, this is what we're hearing from parents, and no one trust does it the same, which actually makes my job a lot harder for the help that I can, you know, give families and advice, because their pathway to diagnosis is so different. You know, I hear from my work that some people get referred to CAMHS by their GP, straight to CAMHS. And if they're lucky enough to get on the list and not turn down because their needs aren't high enough, then the long wait to be seen begins. And some GPs have referred straight to neurologists, which again, with a long waiting list, can be successful. And then there's some GPs that have been known to refer to specialist tic clinics if there is one in the area. But these, as we know, are far and few between. But some GPs will refer to local child development centres if it's not straightforward and there are other complications. So once successful at getting on the list and finally being seen, the next wait, if you like, begins. If Tourette syndrome is suspected and a child needs to be seen to be having both motor and vocal tics for at least a year to get that diagnosis. So, you know, we need to let parents know that it's best really to keep a log with notes and maybe videos dating back to the first time they started to even notice any tics, so that they have a good evidence base that they can draw on by the time they get to be seen. But if there are any suspected co-occurring conditions going on, then, you know, the GP or specialist may refer to another specialist for further investigations. And that's not forgetting all the other tests that may be put in place by specialists that they will do with the support of school, for example, to decide if other conditions such as dyslexia, dyspraxia or ADHD or autism spectrum disorder is present. So you can see how varied the diagnosis pathway to Tourette's can be. You know, and I have known families take up to 3 or 4 years and possibly more to even get the diagnosis that feels right for them.
It's interesting you talking about parents perhaps taking videos. That's something we've heard from clinicians as well, and parents, that the child may not present with tics at the clinic sometimes, which can be a little bit frustrating. So having some video evidence from home and diaries, as you say, could be really helpful in terms of informing the clinician. We touched on earlier that there are behavioural therapy treatment options as well. Sometimes, and maybe in the majority of cases, medication can be offered for where tics are viewed as serious enough for some medication. But there's also behavioural therapy that can be offered as well in some cases. There are the European guidelines on the treatment and management of Tourette syndrome, which can be very useful for clinicians to have. And there they actually state that behavioural therapy should be offered as a frontline treatment for tics. But we do know that there is a lack of trained therapists in the UK. Some parents report not having been given any information at the point of diagnosis about behavioural therapy as a potential treatment. And that's something that hopefully you and others can help change. And parents have described this diagnosis moment as a bit of a cliff where they're not given much information. They're not signposted to support associations or given leaflet information for them to digest afterwards. So that would be something that we would hope to improve upon. And patients report wanting the behavioural therapy, but they're unable to find the help. So hopefully there'll be more training of clinicians in the UK, and hopefully using telemedicine, which we're all getting much more used to now, having meetings and perhaps even clinical consultations over the internet is the way forward to allowing access to many more people. Just thinking about what services are available to the clinicians also to inform the parents about at the point of diagnosis, I'm sure it must be very much more satisfactory also for the clinician to be able to give the information leaflet to the parents and point out that there's a patients association in that country and guide the family towards extra help as well. I've recently been a co-creator of an online directory of support of Tourette syndrome patient associations around the world, and this can be found on the ESTS website, that's the European Society for the Study of Tourette Syndrome, which is a great resource. And there at www.ests.org/directory, it gives an overview of the most important services and contact details of the Tourette Syndrome patient associations really around the world, and I think is the most up-to-date list at the moment. And this allows the professionals to share this information with their patients and open the way to support for them. And this directory has also been forming part of a chapter in a clinical textbook being written at the moment about Tourette Syndrome. So by including it as part of a clinical textbook, it means that point of diagnosis, clinicians can use the chapter to show the patient, maybe photocopy it, what support associations exist in their country. It feels like what is needed then is a sort of more holistic view of the child and how to support them in a kind of multidisciplinary approach with the schools and the clinics, and maybe having a clinical assessment where tics and co-occurring conditions are taken into account. A variety of treatment options might be offered, and a closer relationship between clinics and schools with more awareness of the condition. Is that something that you think, if we're thinking, you mentioned the word gold standard earlier, is that some way towards that? And I should also mention that there are no NICE guidelines for Tourette syndrome. But what would your views be on how to improve this situation at the moment?
Definitely. In some cases, Tourette syndrome can be very, you know, come on very suddenly. And we've had a lot of that over COVID, actually. I have lots of reports of children, you know, having sudden symptoms. And this can be a massive life change for families and very traumatic, to say the least, you know. So it's really important that when this happens, that families have access to clinicians much sooner and to those who are experienced and confident enough to offer advice or signposting to Tourette's regarding schools, to get support in place straight away. Otherwise, we may be facing a lot more mental health issues, and that's a bit of a worry, and possibly school refusal, you know. These children, it's not a case of not wanting to go to school. Sometimes it's a case of they literally cannot because of these issues. And once school refusal happens, that can be quite a slippery slope.
And it feels like also this closer relationship between schools and clinics, you know, it might be helpful if clinicians can also sort of add to the information and training that you offer to schools. There doesn't seem to be any input from them, but they have such expertise that it could be also sort of filtered into the information and training as well.
There should be some flow of information between healthcare professionals and schools. You know, ideally, that would be fantastic. And maybe by feeding this information to schools on behaviour interventions, and that's, you know, obviously that's not to say that we would advise teachers take on any behavioural intervention strategies. That certainly has to be delivered by a skilled therapist. But any advice on how to sort of aid that in school would be very useful for teachers. But also not expecting teachers to carry out these interventions, but there does seem a bit of a missed opportunity to not feed back on what CAMHS wants to see being done in children in school. So it works vice versa, really. It works both ways, you know.
Great. I think it's been a really interesting conversation, listening to all the thoughts and advice that you've got. If listeners to this podcast want to find out more information about the online training or Tourette syndrome awareness, some of the strategies, etc., what would you suggest?
Well, you know, the first line of contact for any family or school would be Tourette's Actions website, I would suggest, where they will be offered information on an option of ways to contact people, you know, either through our live chat facility or our help desk. So I would definitely recommend they get in touch.
Great. And the website address for that is www.tourettes-action.org.uk. They can look at the ACAM website. There's a Tourette Syndrome topic guide and other podcasts there. Lucy, finally, what would your take-home message be?
I think really the important message really here is that spreading awareness is the key, as well as working together and sharing knowledge. And it goes back to that old age saying of, you know, knowledge is power. And I think that by working together, we could make a more powerful, positive impact and a real difference to so many people's lives.
Thank you ever so much, Lucy. That was really fascinating. You can follow Lucy on Twitter at the handle at Lucy Toghill, LucyToghill. And her email is lucy@tourette-action.org.uk. You can follow me, Dr. Seanich Anderson, on Twitter at Seanich Anderso 2. That's capital SEONAIDANDERSO2. And email me at contact@neuro-diverse.org. If anyone listening wants more information on Tourette syndrome, they can visit the ACAM website. That's acamh.org. And you can follow them on social media by searching ACAM.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.